Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The jobless rate of 3.5% in Central Ohio is the lowest in 9 years, a typically reliable sign of a robust economy, but it's complicated. The types of available jobs, the incomes and other benefits that they offer matter too. Today, we're talking about the state of the Central Ohio economy. Joining us is Managing Editor for Columbus Business First, Doug Buchanan. Welcome back, Doug.
Good morning.
And joining us as well, Columbus economist and owner of the local economic consulting company, Regionomics, Bill Lafayette. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
So, Bill, in general, what are the earmarks of a strong economy in 2018? Are they different than, say, 30 years ago?
Well, yes, they are, because the demographics are different now. 30 years ago, we had baby boomers in the labor market in large, large numbers. And now we really don't. Baby boomers are still participating, certainly, but we're starting to retire, and that depresses economic growth.
And even in Central Ohio, the demographics are still a lot more older people than young.
They're certainly skewing younger.
Okay,
but there are a large and growing number of older people. We are going to double our population of 65 plus in, 20 years or so.
Why does that depress the economy?
Just because you have fewer people available to work.
Okay. What, you know, when you look at the economy overall, what factors, Doug Buchanan, are you considering in just reporting about it?
Well, we're certainly looking at the overall number of jobs. And as Bill has pointed out, I mean, that has been improving in Central Ohio. We're one of the bright spots in the state.
Right.
And so that is always going to be important. The second half of that is wage growth, and that has not kept up as much. And I'm very interested, actually, to hear Bill's thoughts on this, because I don't think that there's been a very good, you know, silver bullet explanation for why this is not happening. I think it's a whole series of smaller explanations, but you would expect with the job growth that we're having and the unemployment rate being this low that we should all be enjoying significantly higher wage growth than we're seeing.
Because there's more demand.
There's more demand. And if you go industry by industry and if you look at Bill's forecasts over the years and you see the hot industries especially, I mean, you may be seeing some wage growth particularly in those industries. But overall, it's just not there.
Yeah. You know, when I was reading something that you had said, Bill, about that even though there's a very low jobless rate, it's not the challenge for employers that it was, say, back before the recession when they were offering sign-up bonuses and things like that.
I think you're going to start to see that
sooner
rather than later. Brand new numbers that I looked at showed that we had, I believe, 4.7% year-over-year wage growth in the first 6 months of 2017. Those are the most recent numbers we have now, compared to 0.8% the year before. So wage growth is starting to pick up here and nationally, and that gives rise to concerns over inflation.
Is the lack of wage growth over the last 6 to 7 years, as the job market improved, what is the reason for that? Why has it first of all, has this region lagged the nation in that regard, or has the nation experienced the same stagnant wages?
It's been pretty much a national phenomenon.
Okay.
And I think the explanation is that although the unemployment rate was coming down, there was still a fair amount of what you might call shadow unemployment, people who aren't formally measured in the unemployment rate because they're not actively looking for work, but they would take a job if one were available or if they thought they had the appropriate skills.
And I think that that's actually shown in the hiring statistics. I don't know what time frame we're talking about, but a lot of the people that are are now getting jobs are actually from that pool of people who were discouraged and weren't actually counted toward the unemployment rate. Like, does that sound right to you?
So it's tapping into that. It's tapping into the shadow.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, on one hand, if you're talking of, if you're an employer and you're looking at a labor shortage, that's a good thing because now you are seeing some of these people who, because of the post-recession, just had stopped looking for work, are now coming back into the labor force. And as it pertains to job wage growth, I mean, that helps employers not have to give the kinds of raises that that they normally would if all of these people are now coming out of the woodwork and getting back into the job market. So that's the, you know, the good thing from the employer side. From the employee side, you know, you still have I think a recession hangover for a lot of people to where they're, you know, I mean, it hasn't been that long, and they're still concerned about their own jobs. And but I agree with Bill on the point that I think that over the next year, certainly we should start seeing this logjam break a little bit because, you know, people have a lot more confidence in the job market. You might start seeing people switching jobs, which will eventually potentially raise wages as well.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the economy in 2018 for Central Ohio. With us, you just heard Doug Buchanan. He's managing editor for Columbus Business First. Also with us, Bill Lafayette. He's a Columbus economist and owner of Regionomics. That's an economic consulting firm here in Columbus. If you have a question or comment about the economy, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The kinds of jobs are part of this equation. They just don't pay as much. They're not as high skilled. And another thing is they don't have the same benefits as maybe what the baby boomers grew up enjoying.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're not making quite as much money anyway, and you've got to pay for your health insurance.
Right.
You've got to do this.
Right.
You've got to do that.
Right. And I did a study a couple years back that showed that the jobs that require a college degree were doing okay as far as numerical growth and at least wage maintenance. But jobs not requiring a college degree the wages were falling in inflation-adjusted terms, and there were fewer of them. So that's a big concern for people who don't have the hot skills.
Yeah, not just an education, but the hot skills.
Yeah, yeah, because technical careers, skilled trades, construction companies, manufacturers, distribution companies are screaming for those kind of folks. And there just aren't enough of them because everybody's got told, oh, four-year college degree, that's your only path to success.
We are starting to see that change now in somewhat significant ways that you are seeing more of an emphasis on vocational education at the high school level. And I can't remember the name of the construction trade group here in Central Ohio. They actually started a charter school to try to churn out more skilled people in the skilled trades. So you are seeing, you know, some progress. But again, I mean, that's small numbers at the margins when you're talking about the total demand for construction workers in Central Ohio, which is just exploding and, you know, has been for a couple of years now.
And it's exploding, and it's also got to be competing with demand from the South after the hurricanes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's going to add a whole new layer of difficulty.
Yeah, it hasn't really kicked in yet, but it has to be.
It will.
Yeah.
It definitely will.
It's significant.
Yeah, I mean, it is having a somewhat of an impact on the development cycle in Central Ohio because of, I mean, you're seeing cranes all over the city right now.
Right.
And you've got projects on the drawing board. You've got projects in progress. And the timing of them, you know, you do have to factor in whether you're going to have the workers to be able to build these things and physically build them. And so you are seeing delays in some projects here and there because, you know, they're just trying to slot the projects so that they can ensure that they have the manpower to do it.
Right, right. Retail has lagged in Columbus. The national average shows growth in that sector of almost 10%, but just 3.3% for Central Ohio. What's that costing the region? How do you figure the cost of that on a region, Bill Lafayette?
Well, I guess you have to really go back to why that happened. And I think why that happened was, although retail as a whole wasn't overbuilt, there were some segments of retail, such as drugstores and clothing stores and a couple other sectors, electronics stores, that very much were as we were coming out of the recession. And those segments have been dragging down the hole. The other segment that's been dragging down the hole is what are called non-store retailers. Some of the new Amazon jobs go into that segment. So I'm expecting that things will start looking better there than they were.
So overbuilt in drug stores, electronics, and clothing stores in Central Ohio. Why such a huge lag, though, in those? I mean, is it just because Central Ohio just builds stores and if you build it, they will shop there kind of a mentality? Or how did they overreach so much?
Oh, they overreach on kind of a cyclical basis time and time and time again. Huh. When I started looking at the Central Ohio economy in the late 90s, we had this huge overbuilt retail market. And over the decade, the first decade of this century, we wound up losing 16% of our retail jobs, 20-some thousand.
And, you know, this in particular over the past year has not just been a Central Ohio phenomenon. I mean, this was nationwide. This 2017 was really a rough year for a lot of national retailers, and you saw many of them either declaring bankruptcy, shutting down for good, closing tons of stores, and there was just kind of like this national culling of the retail space for weaker retailers who really can't compete with Amazon.
I mean, right. That's e-commerce kind of,
yeah, the e-commerce issues.
The biggest thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Les Wexner, who knows quite a lot about retail, has been talking down department stores for a while now, and he, you know, his contention is to play. You know, obviously, he built helped build Easton, so he has a vested interest there. But that kind of experiential shopping is really what is going to survive now. Whereas just traditional malls, where you're just going in and looking for clothing, drugs, or whatever else, that is really declining, and so you're seeing the weaker chains just start disappearing. And I don't know that it's going to be as bad this year, but that trend is certainly not going to go away.
We will continue our conversation about the Central Ohio economy. Lots of moving parts. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Make sure you go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Central Ohio real estate market is sizzling. That's good news for sellers, not so good for seekers. What does it say about the overall economy now, and what does it portend for the rest of the year? We're talking about the state of the economy in Central Ohio heading into 2018. Still with us is Columbus economist and owner of the local economic consulting company, Regionomics, Bill Lafayette. Welcome back again.
Thank you, Ann.
And also with us, managing editor for Columbus Business First, Doug Buchanan. Doug, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that housing market. It's super tight. What does it reflect about the economy?
Well, it reflects the confidence in people to be buying homes, is also a pretty profound shift in how people are living. We were talking about baby boomers, off the air, it's adding up to one of the most unusual housing markets that they've seen in Central Ohio mm-hmm. in many, many years, because we're in a situation right now where anybody who puts a house on the market can pretty much be guaranteed you're going to get multiple offers on them and quickly. And the realtors that you talk to, I mean, it's called inventory in their terminology. This inventory has never been this low, mm-hmm. especially when there's this much demand. And so you're really starting to see pressure on prices that are really going higher.
So yay you if you want to sell and just rent somewhere, but or build.
Right. So I think if you're a baby boomer and you're looking to if you're an empty nester and you're looking to downsize, especially if you're going to an apartment or maybe even a condo downtown mm-hmm. or something like that, that you may be in better shape than your average family who's just looking to move from one single family house to another single family house. The good news is you're probably going to get top dollar for that house that you're selling. The bad news is that you're going to then be right into that same buyer's market with everybody else when you're looking for something and you're desperate to find something. You're going to have to pay top dollar for what you go into.
And for that reason, people are staying out. People are just kind of holding on to what they've got.
Right. How does a tight housing market affect an economy long term?
Well, there's less opportunity to attract workers into the community. Mm. If it's hard to buy a house, then people are going to be less willing to relocate.
Right. I think that – I'm sorry. Let me jump in. I think that that has a very serious long-term implication for mm-hmm. Central Ohio because if you look at some of these cities out in California, New York, or even Austin, Texas, places like that, finding affordable housing is next to impossible for most families and for most workers. So as Bill points out, if we're going to be a beacon in the Midwest and a city that is attracting people rather than losing population, we need to have this housing stock that that is not only available but actually affordable. And, I think that's going to be one of our major challenges over the next 5 to 10 years.
Another thing that I'm kind of intrigued by, the big target real estate market is for active empty nesters, these baby boomers who are retiring with savings. They enjoy pensions and long-term savings that a lot of not so much younger people coming up don't have. And I'm wondering, are we going to have a big stock of housing for that active baby boomer today that is not going to be affordable for that next generation of retirees in 25 years?
Could very well be because your real estate stock is your real estate stock.
Right.
Given the demographic shifts that we're going to be seeing over the coming years, the Insight 2050 report, we won't need as much large lot suburban development. We'll need smaller houses, very densely packed, very walkable. That is what they're saying that people want. And it takes a long time to shift a market from the one to the other.
Right.
And to your point, too, if you look at the kinds of retirement communities that are getting built these days that are targeting the baby boomers, these are very, very nice places.
They're upscale.
These are upscale places. So yeah, once the baby boomers kind of push through and the next generation, I think that is.
It doesn't have the savings. It doesn't have the pensions and that long term earnings. It's going to be a different different.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to have really long-term, and Bill can probably talk more detail about it, but I mean, it's going to have significant implications when you talk about entire generations of Americans who don't have retirement savings. I mean, I don't know the percentages. I'd have to, look that up, but it's abysmal. It is absolutely abysmal how much we are saving for our retirement, and there's, very little safety net for anybody.
It's frightening, and it's going to have long-term implications.
Let's take a bigger view of the economy now and put Columbus and Central Ohio in the context of the state of Ohio. It's a beacon.
Yeah.
It's,
mm-hmm.
Things are good, thumbs up, but it's part of a larger equation.
It certainly is. The state's economy is in most places, not doing well at all.
And what do we mean by state's economy? Just that larger, those larger numbers? Or are we talking about the state government, or what?
We're talking about the state.
Okay.
But if you're going to talk about the state, you have to talk about regions within the state, because every region behaves differently. But in general, you've got very, very modest employment growth over the course of the expansion. Mm-hmm. You've got, in many places, a loss of population. And so the problem for us is kind of twofold. On the one hand, the people who live out there come and shop here. The people who own businesses out there buy from vendors here. And so to the extent that they're struggling, we feel it. And on top of that, there's the obvious problem with the state budget. If the state budget is constrained and they're not buying from local vendors and they're not hiring local workers, then we feel it much more directly and through that course.
Yeah, certainly the rest of the state, I'd have to look at the population numbers, but I mean, we're one of the very few regions in Ohio that is not losing population, right?
Well, we are the only region that's growing faster than the national average.
Okay, all right, sure. Okay.
Cleveland is losing. Cincinnati is gaining modestly.
Right.
Many of the smaller metros are losing.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back, I'm from Northeast Ohio, and if you go back to some of these old industrial cities, I mean, they are very much struggling. And I agree with Bill's point that the overall economy, overall state economy, is going to have an impact on us. But on the other hand, we do continue to be the one spot that everybody wants to move to. We do have that going for us. But Bill and I were talking earlier. If you're an island in the middle of just a very bad economy on all sides of you, then that's not good for your long-term economic growth.
We're talking about the economy in 2018 for Central Ohio. Of course, we just been referencing it in terms of the state at large, and not so good. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. President Trump signed a tax reform package into law on December 20th. Bill, the ramifications of that, of course, are unclear. But what will you be looking at to gauge its impact in the future?
I'll be looking at consumer expenditures to a large extent, because consumer expenditures are 70% of gross domestic product. And if consumers are spending their tax refunds, then it'll be stimulative. Business investment, too,
mm-hmm.
Has some economists are saying that it's set up for growth. It may or may not be, but to the extent that that capital is, the capital stock isn't enough to produce what is needed, then there's going to be capital investment.
Yeah, I think you want to watch. You do want to look at cap. You want to look at investment by these companies that are getting this windfall. And ideally, you'd like to see hiring. Getting more to Bill's point, you'd like to see some wage growth if they're going to use that money. I mean, it's basically the hope would be that they would put this money to good use and not simply use it to, fund stock buybacks or bank it or, do whatever else.
But that's what they've been doing. There's tons of capital they've been sitting on. They didn't need capital in the first place.
Capital utilization rates in some industries are still pretty low.
Right.
And so if you don't need as much as you've got now, why would you buy more?
Right.
Mm. Well, there you go. Yeah. And then that gets back to the question, in Ohio, do we have the economic growth, you know, to spur our manufacturers on? I mean, I certainly think that there are some sectors within manufacturing that are doing well and expanding. The auto production in the state just continues to – you see a lot of investment in that. You're seeing new plants come up from Honda and from suppliers and from, you know, Ford, GM across the state. So that's a good thing. It just needs to be more broad-based and felt, as Bill pointed out, like actually in the consumer spending. It needs to flow down from there.
What is the fiduciary duty of a publicly owned company to its stockholders, to its shareholders, I should say?
To maximize the amount of money they can make.
They're supposed to. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. So
maximize the value to the shareholders.
Their fiduciary duty is not to their employees.
Correct.
Yeah, it's not to the not to the greater good.
Not to the greater good.
No. No, absolutely not. And again, you know, you would certainly hope that some of that longer term fiduciary duty to create value in your enterprise would be in investing in new equipment, potentially investing in acquisitions, investing in new business lines, you know, anything that will get you that that growth. You would think that that, you know, and they do take those long term views, but that's kind of always been the criticism of Poe, especially if you're going to go public, is that you end up with a very short term view of reaching what Wall Street wants in each particular quarter, and it, you know, kind of the long term better overall things kind of take a back seat.
Right.
I was listening to an interesting story on NPR this morning. About a German company and about this kind of middle level of manufacturing in Germany. Yep. And it's a strong part of their economy. They don't know how long it'll last, but it sprung from, you know, post-World War II.
Yep.
And it's a lot of family-owned companies that can take a longer view. They're not publicly owned.
Yeah. And they also to Bill's point earlier, they are also are very strong on vocational education.
Yes.
And
yes.
Putting people to work in manufacturing, like directly from high school into manufacturing. They do a much, much better job than America does on that.
They pay better. They have better benefits.
Right, the
they have state benefits.
Yeah.
There's a lot of more of a safety net.
Yes, there is. But, you know, they're going to have higher taxes. You know, I mean, that's always the trade-off, right? And we just, as a nation, decided to slash the tax rate in the hopes that the overall economy will be doing better. But, yeah, that safety net is just not part of the equation as much here.
Right. And by the way, that's part two of this tax reform is what's going to get cut. They're talking about entitlements. They're talking about Social Security, Medicare, that kind of a thing, Medicaid.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be very easy to cry poor over the next you know, year or two as we're discussing and debating this, or as Congress is discussing and debating that, because all of a sudden you do have $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion you know,
that won't be going.
Be going to that. So, yeah, I would very much expect to see that other shoe to drop pretty soon here. But again, that's the, you know, that's the economy
that we have
chosen. Elections matter.
Is that something you're going to be looking at? I mean, is there a way to measure the multiplier effect of pulling $1.5 trillion out of the economy by way of government?
It certainly is going to have an impact. And you can see it in GDP, because one of the components of GDP is government expenditures, which, interestingly enough, is building roads and bridges. It is not the kind of transfer payments that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
kind of that's government, but it's not measured as such.
Okay.
You'll see it in consumer expenditures.
All right. Yeah, so who knows? Maybe we do get an infrastructure bill within the coming year, and you know that.
Although they're saying it's going to be a lot more modest, and it's going to be again competing for those workers.
Most certainly.
With the private,
is that. But again, you push that much money into the economy. You know, even a modest infrastructure bill is still going to be a pretty big. It's going to be a pretty big number. And you push that in the economy and you know, boom, it works. I mean, it does stimulate.
There are great models for training and equipping new workers in technical fields. You have to give them the technical skills, but you also have to address their personal needs for childcare, perhaps for drug rehab, for transportation. And there are good models out there for how to do it.
The drug issue's been a big problem.
Very
measurable, that you just aren't enough people that, to employ that can pass a drug test.
I did a project in southeastern Ohio that involved talking to a bunch of manufacturing leaders. And one of them told me, I'll never forget this, I could hire 10 people in the door today if I could find 10 people who could pass a drug test.
Yeah, we hear that a lot, actually, mm-hmm. that, you know, because, again, you know, a lot of these industries, especially once you leave Central Ohio and the labor pool is smaller, they're desperate for workers, but they're desperate for workers who can pass a drug test. And that has been a significant impediment. And I would assume that that's only going to get worse as we roll out medical marijuana here in September, I think it's supposed to start this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we
haven't even crested the opioid crisis yet.
No.
It's starting to look that way, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be much worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you remember on the medical marijuana thing, I mean, the employers, it was explicitly put in the law to get it to pass that employers still could drug test and still could fire for those offenses. So that will, you know, continue to be an issue.
I guess employers maybe start asking themselves tough questions about, do they really care if somebody smokes recreational pot?
Mm-hmm. Well, do they care and do their insurers care? Does workers' comp care?
That's the trick. It's expensive.
Yeah.
Right.
You get a significant break if you're going to, you know, if you're going to drug test. So it's a very much a financial as well as kind of an ethical, moral question as you think about what you're going to do there. Because if you need the workers, at some point you're just going to have to make the decision, I'm going to bite that bullet and just make this policy change. But, so far, I don't think that's very widespread.
I guess some lessons from California is that they roll out their recreational marijuana sales on January 1st. We are talking about the economy of Ohio, of Central Ohio, but there's all kinds of moving parts when we're discussing that. I'm glad you're joining us for the conversation. If you have any questions or would like to give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the state of the economy in Central Ohio as we venture into 2018. Still with us, Columbus economist and owner of Regionomics, Bill Lafayette. Also, managing editor for Columbus Business First, Doug Buchanan. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, now is the chance. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Doug Buchanan, you mentioned earlier when I asked about the tax cut at the federal level, you said, hey, we've made a choice. Now, you know, we'll see how it rolls out. We've made other choices as a community, one of which is to not pursue high-speed mass transit in the state of Ohio and beyond buses. And Bill Lafayette, I mean, at what point do we need to invest big time? And we continue to invest big time in the infrastructure around it. I live up in Worthington and, you know, the big fix was a really big fix up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No problem. And it's better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a highway.
It's a highway, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can only expand highways so much. And if we're going to get 500,000 people to 1 million people here in the next 35 years, we're going to have to do something a little bit more drastic than fix highways.
And that's an interesting point when you talk about the smart city thing that we got last year. They've leveraged this. It was initially a $50 million federal-private thing. They've leveraged it into $500 million or something like that in pledges. And You know, a big part of this is, you know, since we do not have high-speed rail, that we are now the technological testbed for alternative transportation methods and systems. And, I mean, I don't know how this is going to work. I'm not sure that even the people involved in the Smart City program here at the city know exactly how it's going to work. I mean, that's why we're seeing, like, even though a year has passed since we got this award, there's very little concrete evidence that you're seeing. I mean, they're still just trying to figure out what they're going to test and where. And so, you know, I think I just plainly do not see a light rail system coming, you know, anytime soon. But what you are going to see is stuff like the CMAX line that you guys reported on this morning, where you just try to have technological fixes to, you know, make, you know, I guess to make cars and buses move around the region more effectively. I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here. So there is going to be a lot of money. There's going to be a lot of investment. There's going to be a lot of interesting things going on, but it's just not going to be, at least in my opinion, maybe Bill has a different opinion, that, you know, a traditional kind of light rail system.
The one thing that you really have to figure out, and you always have to figure this out, is the first mile and the last mile.
Hmm. Yeah,
there was a really interesting article in City Lab that talked about us winning this grant and then profiling this woman who lives in Linden who was trying to get to her doctor and just having all kinds of trouble doing that. That's the kind of thing you have to fix. And I'm really encouraged by Mayor Ginther pointing out that, yes, that sort of thing is very important.
Debbie Holmes here at WOSU profiled a woman who travels 3 hours each way to get to a job that barely pays not much more than minimum wage.
Right. Yeah. And you hear stories
about that.
Yeah, you hear stories about that all over Central Ohio because you've got the big employment centers, let's say, you know, the warehouses down at Rickenbacker, the retail and all the offices in New Albany, you know, things like that. And as Bill points out, I mean, we can kind of get people close to it or we can get people close to their homes. But if you're going to rely on public transportation to get from Linden to Rickenbacker, you're in for a long commute. And that's, you know, true for most of the you know, major employment centers around here.
Well, two things. I mean, going forward into the future, affordable housing and affordable transportation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right, and they're
neither of which looking really good right now.
Yeah.
No, right, and so you know, on the transportation side, I think again that is the hope of Smart City, that even if we don't know what it looks like yet, that we will be putting in some systems, you know, some new thing in place to help with that. But
when I think about the smart cities, and I think about that grant, and I think about, you know. How do people who are barely making ends meet afford not just a smartphone, but the data that it's going to require to use it and to call on and tap into this? Who's going to pay for that?
Right, and you know, right. I think that there are definite drawbacks to a lot of these approaches because, you know, another one of the things they were testing were like smart cars, autonomous smart cars, you know, going here, there, you know, different places. But I mean, how many people is that really going to affect? Like, how many people is that going to get from point A to point B to their jobs? I mean, it almost seems like, you know, it's just
a drop in the bucket.
Drop in the bucket.
Yeah. You really have to talk to the folks with mobility challenges as opposed to talk about them and ask them what they need. How can we solve your problem?
Yeah. So again, as you talk about people, half a million, a million people coming into the region, where are they going to live, and then where are they going to, you know, in relation to where the good jobs are, and you know, if there's no way to, you know, if you can only live next to where the hot jobs are, then that's probably a hot neighborhood, and then you have an affordable housing problem. If you where, you know, there's not good transportation, you can get an affordable house, but you're never going to get your job affordably. I mean, it's a vicious cycle.
Yes.
It's a problem.
Ohio's minimum wage went up 15 cents on January 1st. Does that matter, Bill Lafayette?
It matters. if you got away a raise and you are a low-income worker, you're going to spend it all. And so, yes, it matters. Although as far as the adequacy of the minimum wage to live, it remains nowhere close.
Falls very short.
Yeah, yeah, it's in the high teens, low 20s.
For a living wage.
For a living wage.
Yeah. And we're at, what, 867 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean,
a living wage being the wage that you need to meet your basic needs yourself without public assistance of some sort.
Mm, right. Right. And, yeah, I mean, some cities have gone as high as 15. Am I right on that?
I've seen that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a question. I mean, anytime you raise the minimum wage, you got to have the restaurant owners and the businesses complain. They potentially will not hire as many people. I mean, there's that trade-off. But, I don't think that we've reached the level that some of these – since we have not reached the level that some of these other cities have trying, I can't imagine that that's going to have the big effect on hiring that, that maybe the –
It'd just be a little bit of
a little extra money
the economy, right. Moving around.
Figuring that dynamic out is unbelievably complex.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine.
Sean in Lima, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you, Ann?
Fine, thank you.
I have a couple of quick comments. I remember being I was a little boy back in the 60s, and we used to shop at Woolworths.
Mm-hmm.
At Christmas time was my favorite time of year to shop because you'd go into Woolworths in the Lima Mall and there'd be whistle trains running all over the floor and there would be the smell of caramel corn and who knows what all. And it was just an atmosphere that I just loved. I just remember that. But one other comment I wanted to bring up real quick, and I'll listen to your comments. I am a visually impaired person that I do shopping, but I don't like shopping online, and I'll tell you why. I know it's everybody says it's a trend, but that shopping online to me is not good for somebody who's visually impaired, and I'll tell you. I want to feel what I'm buying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like if you're shopping for a car. Do you really want to shop online for a car? No. I want to feel that car. I want to feel whatever I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying, Sean. It's certainly not uncommon to hear this remark. On the other hand, if I want to buy Percale sheets, I know a set of Percale sheets is going to be the same. Kind of not everything works online, but some things work better than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you're even starting to see these online car sites pop up, not just the online inventory at your local dealer, but like you can, buy online and have the thing delivered to you anymore. But yeah, I think the key to his comments were he mentioned growing up in the 60s.
Yeah.
So that's a generational thing to where plenty of us still
We know it.
Oh, yeah. The Springfield Mall.
Remember the Five and Dime?
Oh, gosh, yes. Downtown Springfield.
Oh, God,
with all the neon and all the
caramel corn.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, your dad would give you a couple bucks and say, go buy everybody a Christmas present.
Sure.
Yeah, I can't remember whose commercial it was, but there was a commercial over the holidays where they showed people giving presents, and the one woman said something, here's the thing from the link that you sent me. And, it was like so impersonal, how we give presents and how we shop these days. But as I said earlier, I mean, there definitely are still people who like to go to the malls. I like to go shopping. It's just that the long-term trends there are just not good for physical retail.
But they're not bad for mom and pop. Per se. A lot of people shop locally. They want to do that.
Yeah. And that's very important.
Yeah, very much. The kinds of things that I'm talking about where you're seeing kind of the large scale disruptions in retail, we're talking about basically mall based operators. And so you're absolutely right. The short north continues to just be an incredible draw, not only for the restaurants, but for the shopping that's available there. And they have very few kind of chain retailers in there. It's a lot of mom and pop shops.
Mm-hmm.
Sean, thanks a lot for that call. Thanks for listening. The Toledo Blade reported on the economic impact of casinos 5 years after voters approved them. And I was wondering, what has the Hollywood Casino brought to the region? Is that anything? Is that even on your radar anymore?
I mean, kind of, sort of. I mean, we keep waiting for things to develop out there on the west side. And, I mean, they just really haven't. Mall is still sitting there. It's still a big, dead mall right next to it.
I often wonder if it wouldn't have been better to have it downtown, as far as it would have been part, you know, of something.
I think the casino operators would certainly agree with you that
would have been entertainment district.
It would have been in the middle of an entertainment district. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, if you go to Cincinnati and Cleveland, they're pretty close to downtowns as well, and is kind of more integrated into the city. But yeah, I mean, they what can you really point to out there when you're driving in that area that says, oh, well, this was, you know, this would be a definite side effect from the casino? I'm not seeing a whole lot out there.
Well, I guess from an economic standpoint, the real answer is, what is the percentage of people who come into that casino from outside Central Ohio?
Okay.
Because if you're somebody who lives in Columbus and goes out and gambles at the casino, that's money that you would not have spent by going out to eat or by going to a movie or something else. It's displacing spending.
But it also might be money that you might have gone to Las Vegas and spent.
That's
before.
True. That's very true. So to the extent that your spending is trapped, then that's an offset. But in general, local spending is a wash.
And, again, if you were about to talk about trap money, I mean, casinos make it very easy for you to go in there and not come out. You know, you can eat.
That's their business model.
Yeah, that's their business model. So if you're, again, if you're looking at the Westland area and you're kind of looking around there to see, have new restaurants opened, have new hotels opened, have we seen something that would account for, as Bill points out, this money that would not have been in that region of the city? Are we seeing some effect of all of that money flowing into there? Or is it just simply going into the casino and not coming back out again? I think it's more the latter.
Yes.
There's talk, strong talk, about the crew leaving Columbus. It was not unlike the casino, apart from what we think of as the entertainment district in downtown Columbus. That was a problem, apparently. Now nothing will satisfy the owners, I guess. But be that as it may, an economic impact of a professional soccer team leaving the very, you know, where the first soccer stadium was built in the country.
Yes.
What about that? Does that portend anything in particular, Bill Lafayette?
It's a large employer leaving town.
Okay.
I think there's a kind of a psychological blow that wouldn't exist if a comparably sized, say, retailer left town.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a very disappointing thing if it happens.
Yeah,
I agree. It's the image, the city's image as one, as bad as Cleveland as a city is doing, they still have, major league sports teams. Cincinnati's got two, and they're about to get an MLS team, you know, as well. And so just from the outside looking in, for a city that already is struggling with an identity, finding some identity, especially beyond just being the home of Ohio State. If you're talking about one of our teams picking up and moving, especially if it moves to Texas, we already have enough problems competing with Texas and with our, you know, our population, losing population to Sun Belt cities in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have a very high profile business, a very profile sports team saying Columbus is just not as dynamic and as growing a city as Austin, Texas, and that's where we're taking it.
I mean, adding insult to injury.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much so.
Well, I don't want to end on a low note, but we have to because we've run out of time. Doug Buchanan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's Doug Buchanan. He's editor-in-chief at Columbus Business First. And also Bill Lafayette, Chief Columbus economist and owner of Regionomics. Thanks again for joining us, as always.
Thanks a lot, Ann.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.